You're listening to The Takeaway Podcast. Check out our website at thetakeaway.org. You'll find other interesting stories, quizzes, and behind-the-scenes photos and videos.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Justice and injustice this hour, a look at the parallel legal universe for immigrants in America. We'll also have a look back at a famous L.A. criminal case remembered as a misuse of the court system. Speaking of parallel universes, we look at how the series Cosmos, which premiered last night in primetime, may end up inspiring a new generation of scientists, just like the last Cosmos series did. Some very inspiring young scientists later this hour. And you can make this stuff up, it turns out, how the fictional series House of Cards eerily got it right on the fate of some legislation in Congress. We'll talk about that. But first, you probably aren't aware that over the weekend, 750 detained immigrants went on hunger strike out in Tacoma, Washington, protesting delays in their deportation cases and in the conditions of their detention facilities. You probably know nothing about the Colorado case of Raul and Judy Cardenas either, and their three kids. The federal government was trying to deport immigrant Raul, even though he was married to Judy. Their only recourse to prevent their family being broken up was a hearing before an immigration judge.
The prosecutor didn't even have the file. The file is with DHS because of the requests we've made. The petition is still pending. The marriage petition is still pending. And the request for prosecutorial discretion is still pending.
That inconclusive 8-minute hearing took place back in 2011. In 2012, the administration changed its deportation policy, however, and the Cardenas case was eventually closed. But as of this month, the Obama administration will have deported 2 million immigrants, illegal and legal, for various offenses under a court system that is universally understood to be overworked and understaffed and faced with the conundrum of Congress's inability to enact meaningful immigration reform. For judges, this can be beyond frustrating. We spoke to Judge Dana Marks, president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She joined us from KQED in San Francisco, where she's been an immigration judge for 27 years.
We believe that we are at a crisis point in terms of a lack of resources. Public debate rages on about exactly what complexion the law should have in terms of what rights and benefits are afforded to non-citizens of the United States. But the immigration courts are an often forgotten piece of the immigration removal process. More money has been spent on the immigration removal process than any other law enforcement initiatives, federally speaking, combined. And yet the immigration courts have remained a stagnant afterthought in terms of funding.
And what is the consequence of that stagnation been in the style of the proceedings, the extent to which due process is actually given to immigrants?
Well, there's an adage in law in general which states that justice delayed is justice denied. So in San Francisco, for example, I have 2,500 pending cases on my docket. That means that it takes more than a year for someone to get their first hearing before me, and that hearing is simply an arraignment-type hearing where we triage and try to figure out what we need to do to bring that case to trial and make it ready for a trial. And at that arraignment-type hearing, it's then another 2.5 to 3 years before I can even get a case to my final docket. I'm currently setting cases in the fall of 2017. To give you a perspective nationwide, there are now approximately 360,000 cases pending before immigration judges, and the current staffing of the immigration judge corps is only 233 sitting immigration judges with an additional 15 immigration judges nationwide whose primary responsibility is supervisory and management.
Would I recognize a court proceeding that involved an immigrant plaintiff or defendant?
We call them respondents in immigration court proceedings. And the biggest difference is the fact that people do not have a right to appointed counsel. They have the right to provide an attorney at their own expense. But nationwide, 60% of the cases proceed to hearing without an attorney representative. And if you consider only the detained docket, people who are incarcerated during the course of their hearings, 85% of those individuals are not represented by counsel. We record our proceedings on digital audio recordings rather than a court reporter, so the judge has to make his or her decision without a written transcript. And we have a layer of complexity that most courts don't face. The vast majority of the cases that come before an immigration judge are presented through a foreign language interpreter.
The ABA back in 2009 made a number of recommendations to fix the court or address some of these concerns. They wanted the hiring of additional 100 judges. Did that ever happen?
No, it did not. And we're still hoping for that sometime soon.
There was also a lot of talk in the commission report about how there's a wide variance in the quality of the decisions on the part of judges. The standardization of training for immigration judges is not what it should be, and that even Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez addressed some of these concerns in 2006, attempting to upgrade the quality of the judge corps. Did any of that happen?
The short answer is no. I can't speak to policy in my role as the National Association of Immigration Judges, but I can say that it doesn't serve anyone's interest to not have adequate resources at the immigration courts. Some people are cynical and believe that non-citizens benefit from the delay and try to encourage delay in the system since it allows them to remain longer. But the judges don't believe that that is true on the whole. People with meritorious cases can suffer grave injury to their case because of the fact that they can't bring their case to hearing. There are certain benefits under the immigration law which require a qualifying relative who is a minor, or a qualifying relative who will suffer exceptional or extremely unusual hardship. Often that hardship is medically related. So people lose their qualifying relatives due to the passage of time because they reach the age of majority, or sometimes, tragically, due to death because their case is not heard in a timely fashion before their loved one dies.
What's the longest time that you're aware of a respondent who was incarcerated during a delay of the kinds that you're speaking of?
It is true that the Executive Office for Immigration Review prioritizes the cases of detained non-citizens so that they are not languishing in a detention facility. But it can be years on end between the actual proceeding before the immigration judge and the various appeals processes that are available afterwards.
You've seen people in that situation, right?
Yes, I have. People are often very surprised to learn that a stress study done of immigration judges showed that the level of stress in our corps in 2009 rated immigration judges as high on the stress and burnout scales as prison wardens and busy hospital room doctors.
Have you ever felt as though respondents have fallen through the cracks in your court system at some of these very brief hearings that you understood on some level that the verdict you were delivering was not necessarily going to represent justice, but there was nothing you could do about it?
There are times that immigration judges are called upon to make very difficult decisions. There is no doubt that the immigration laws are extremely strict at the present time. For example, someone convicted of petty theft with a prior conviction is considered to be an aggravated felon under the immigration definition of that term. That has very harsh consequences. That can mean that someone who has been a lawful permanent resident from the time they were a small child and had no other criminal activity except for repeated petty thefts can be precluded from remaining in the United States, which may be the only country that he or she knows, that person can in essence be exiled from the country that has become their home.
So you have the power to tear up a family over someone who's shoplifted.
I have the duty at times to separate family members. If I find that the law itself does not allow me to consider some kind of relief from removal for that person. And when Congress tries to micromanage every outcome by making the law so specific as it did, for example, with petty theft with a prior being an aggravated felony. And, of course, we know it's certainly not aggravated, and it may not even be a felony in some situations. When those kinds of decisions are predetermined, instead of being allowed to weigh all of the factors, both positive and negative, it does not achieve as just a result. And the immigration judges are fighting to try to get some discretion back into the courtrooms. We're members of our local communities. We don't want to allow someone that's going to be a danger to the community to remain any more than people in Congress do. But we need to have a more refined tool to use to evaluate that, rather than the broad categories which simply preclude the immigration judge from using his or her judgment to make that determination. We need more discretion in the law to allow the judges to weigh those factors and come to a fair and just result.
I'm curious, what you describe as a fix here, getting the immigration court system out from under the Attorney General's office in the Department of Justice and making it an independent Article I court, that's a recommendation that's been around since the early 1980s.
That's correct. But law is glacial in its speed for change. The National Association of Immigration Judges has been fighting for years to accomplish that. We have gained the support in that cause, and since 1981 by getting organizations like the American Bar Association and the Federal Bar Association, extremely prestigious legal groups, to endorse that concept. And now it's our job to convince Congress and the American public that this is an essential step which needs to be taken soon.
Judge Marks, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Judge Marks is president of the National Association of Immigration Judges. She's been an immigration judge in San Francisco for 27 years.
See that asteroid? No, not that one. The one over there. We exist because the gravity of that one next to it just nudged it an inch to the left. What difference could an inch make on the scale of the solar system? Just wait. You'll see.
Big Bad Cosmic Science went prime time again last night with the premiere of Cosmos, the TV series narrated by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson and inspired by the late astronomer and science celebrity Dr. Carl Sagan, who hosted his own Cosmos TV show back in the 1980s. Sagan didn't just inspire some TV shows, though, to grapple with the big, outstanding questions about the universe. Listen.
Whether Earth is unique, whether there are more planets like Earth around the sun. Because right now, that's actually we're just at the tip of finding thousands of planets around other stars, but a planet that's exactly like Earth, around a star that's exactly like the sun, is just outside of our grasp.
You know, the Kepler Space Telescope has just been a dazzling success, showing all of these planets, something like 1,700 confirmed planets now.
Lost count.
And I've seen estimates up to a trillion planets. I mean, this is just really awesome, super exciting.
Later this hour, we'll hear more from those voices, all of whom took interesting paths to becoming scientists, and about the people, including Carl Sagan, who inspired them along the way. Scientists passing the torch to a new generation. That's later this hour.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
It's C-SPAN meets Netflix on a major issue before the U.S. Congress.
I rise today to speak about the need to strengthen our military and stand by our brave men and women in uniform by passing the Bipartisan Military Justice Improvement Act.
That's the junior senator from New York State, Democrat Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, speaking last week for her bill intended to curb sexual assault in the military by taking those cases out of the chain of command to be judged exclusively in military courts. Gillibrand got a lot of support, but in the end, not enough. And among the members of her own party voting against it was Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri.
I want to thank Senator Gillibrand. We both want fundamental reform. We both are working as hard as we know how to get it. We have a fundamental disagreement about how best to obtain that goal.
two women on an issue presumably of great importance to women, even though both men and women are victims of sexual assault in the military. In this case, Gillibrand lost. She has 3 years less seniority in the Senate than McCaskill. Was that the issue? It sounds a little like the power politics you might hear in season two of the Netflix series House of Cards.
Do you realize the message this sends? The only woman in congressional leadership in both parties, and you bow out?
If the bill goes to the floor as is, I won't just bow out. I'll actively fight it. You never asked my position. You assumed.
I can't imagine what that position must be.
I've served in war zones. I know firsthand how important.
We're not talking about war zones. We're talking about sexual assault.
Bo Willimon is here with me. He's the creator of the Netflix series House of Cards. Bo, welcome.
Thanks for having me, John.
So let's just review the bidding. We've got, in reality, Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri and Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. And on your series, it's Claire Underwood and Majority Whip Jackie Sharp.
That's right. When we first began working on this storyline well over a year ago, Senator Gillibrand had not introduced her bill to Congress yet. I had seen a very early screening of a great documentary called Invisible War, which was subsequently nominated for an Oscar.
Amazing film.
Yes, it tackled this issue head on in a pretty sophisticated and serious way.
So we don't want people who are watching House of Cards now to, you know, get the story given away here necessarily. But it is interesting to me that you really got the narrative very, very close to what's actually going on in Congress right now, that this is a real tough call for Claire McCaskill in Missouri, who has her sort of creds as a tough on defense, senator in the crosshairs, even though she's not up for reelection.
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is a very complicated issue. And when we began to tackle it, we did our research. You know, there's a lot of debate as to how one should confront sexual assault in the military and a lot of different proposed solutions. We explored those in our show, and then we've seen it play out in real life over the past year.
And, often I think what draws people into your program is the idea that the motives of the characters involved aren't necessarily the most high-minded, that it's power politics, that it's seniority over principle. Is that what you saw playing out in your script? And is it, I think, going on in real life on this issue?
A lot of people on our show are engaged in pure self-interest. But in this particular case, Jackie Sharp opposes Claire's bill because, as she said, she served in the military herself, and she places high value on chain of command and thinks that Claire's approach might erode that. So she's coming from a place, actually, of deep ideology about this issue. So, Claire has her strong feelings because of things that she went through in her past. So we see people in this case who are not out for pure self-interest but who have different ideas colliding.
Did you hear from any of the staff members, any of the people, the principals, Gillibrand's office, McCaskill's office, as this was going on?
No, we didn't have direct contact with either of their offices. Of course, they didn't know that we were working on
right.
this story.
And how do you deal with that? I mean, would you tell them, hey, we're working on this story that you've sponsored a bill on, we'd love to get some advice from you or something like that?
No, we followed it closely, but you have to understand that the writing for these episodes happened many, many months ago. So we were done with our scripts well before the debate that we've seen really flaring up over the last several months even took place.
So then did somebody email one to McCaskill? you would have no knowledge of that, but I'm just being conspiratorial. I'm being Kevin Spacey here.
No, we did. We take security very seriously on House of Cards, so I hope that no one emailed the script their way. But look, we've had a number of issues on the show that we worked on well in advance, and then they started to surface in the real world. There's a flare up in the East China Sea that occurs on our show. We were working on that well before that happened in real life.
How's the Crimea script going?
Our focus in season two is China. What is to happen in seasons to come, you can only find out by streaming it once it launches.
You know, I think I've asked this of you before, but now that we're in the middle of something here, do you aspire to have influence in the sense that there would be characters on Capitol Hill who would actively, espouse the values of characters on House of Cards? Or do you just want to be watched by the folks on Capitol Hill in Washington and at the White House?
Our show doesn't have a political agenda. We're not actively seeking to influence policy in Washington. That said, in season two, we made mention of Barrett Brown, who is facing over 100 years of charges. He was an activist journalist who's been incarcerated in the Dallas area for over a year for including a link to hacked material in a story that he wrote about possible connections between private security surveillance firms and the U.S. government. In our show, we had a hacker who actually discussed Barrett Brown by name and wanted the FBI to reduce his charges. Last week, 11 of 17 of Barrett Brown's charges were in fact dropped. I think there were a lot of factors that contributed to that, but who knows? Maybe House of Cards contributed in its own small way.
Do you think House of Cards encourages people to embrace a life of public service or encourages people to go to Washington to get a taste of the intrigue and the drama?
Our goal isn't to try to encapsulate all of Washington and all of America's politics into one show. No one show could do that. We take a definitively dark angle. At times it's exaggerated, so it's not meant to be reflective of everyone in Washington. But whenever you put ambition and power into the same stew, sometimes you get people like Frank Underwood.
Bo Willimon, creator of the Netflix series House of Cards, congratulations on bumping up against reality a little bit on the program in season two.
Thanks. I guess I can take that as congratulations.
Yeah, I think it is.
Some of these issues, we don't treat lightly. They are important. And the main thing is that the country finds somewhere in the middle where most people can agree on the right steps forward.
Thanks, Bo.
Thanks.
This week, our friends at the Retro Report documentary team look back at a courtroom drama that dragged on for years and produced, among other things, a climate of mistrust between parents and preschool teachers during the mid-1980s.
It started out here in Manhattan Beach looking like an isolated incident. One mother noticed that her young son was having nightmares and difficulty sitting down. Authorities now believe that at least 60 young children were victimized and that the ultimate number could well be much greater.
KABC reporter Wayne Satz breaking the McMartin preschool story. Sex abuse allegations against teachers and school staff in a community near Los Angeles. Allegations that eventually included accusations of forcing children to be part of satanic rituals.
The truth about Satanism is they truly do use blood and they mix it with urine. And this is what 1,200 molested kids in the city of Manhattan Beach have told the sheriff's department.
Focus of the Nation was on this case, and the testimony of kids combined to produce what the courts ultimately saw as a horrible injustice, reality apparently bent by the distorted lens of parental fear and extraordinary media attention. Barbara Dury, contributing producer for Retro Report, joins me now. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you.
So this McMartin case transformed how kids are dealt with in courtrooms, but to remind us of just the spectacle that it produced at the time.
Well, it was quite shocking. Here you had a preschool that was quite prominent in a local small community, upper middle class community, had been in business for decades, and accusations were floating around that hundreds of children over decades had been molested by the teachers in the school.
321 counts of child abuse involving 48 children was the final tally. These names, Virginia McMartin, Peggy McMartin, Bucky, Ray Bucky, Peggy Ann Bucky, were all household names.
They had become household names almost overnight.
And it was 7 years, and the district attorney's office spent millions of dollars on the case. How did it turn out?
Not guilty on all of them. In fact, 18 months in, there was a long preliminary hearing, and the district attorney at the time, Ira Reiner, said it was a mere accusation. They couldn't take those further.
What we're left with at this point is that for 5 of the 7 defendants in the McMartin case, the evidence is so slim that it does not go beyond the mere accusation.
It was special evidence, the testimony of children, and that's really at the heart of this case. How does that work?
That is at the heart. What happened was the prosecutor sent the children to CII, Children's Institute International. And the therapist there began interviewing them, and they found that more than 90% of the 400 that they interviewed had been molested.
Here's Stephen Ambrose, who's a senior vice president at that organization, Children's Institute International.
I think our therapists, in many respects, started out being very careful about that back then. But, you know, as they became more persuaded that something had happened, there probably were some leading questions.
Therapy does not constitute legal questioning, at least in terms of the way the courts view it. The media attention amplified all of this. What are we left with at this point?
I guess the takeaway is that hysteria and real child abuse can exist. And perhaps if they had handled it a bit differently in the beginning, less leading, less suggestive questions to the children, you might have had a very different outcome.
What happened to the kids?
One child recanted several years ago. He apologized to Ray Buckey. But you haven't heard anything from the other children. And a lot of them were three, four, maybe 5 years old. So what their memory is of it is unclear.
Amazing. And somewhere they carry that experience in their lives today.
Many therapists believe that it's probably permanent memories were instilled in them. In other words, they believe that they were molested.
Barbara Dury is a contributing producer for a Retro Report looking back at the McMartin preschool sex abuse trial. Barbara, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We are the pioneers, and we are going to be the one who set the stage for the rest of the sport.
Well, the one thing you can count on is absolutely nothing.
You never let your guard down and always play hard as you can play.
This is the home stretch right here. One more feature to navigate.
You know, just got to go with what you got.
This isn't just about skiing.
An all-out fight to the finish.
There's no such thing as can't.
Pushing it till the end, and he's got another gold medal.
The Olympics in Sochi are over. The weather is warming on the mountainous Black Sea coast, even while the politics in Russia and Ukraine right now is tense. But the Paralympics are underway nonetheless, and each day this week we'll be profiling an American athlete in each one of the five events. Ralph Green represents Team USA in the Paralympic downhill event as a one-leg amputee. He lost his leg as the result of being in the crossfire of a street shooting in New York. And he is the first African-American man to make the U.S. Paralympic alpine skiing national team.
It's such a great honor to be able to represent this country in my third games. And, of course, you know, being born and raised in Bedford-Stuyvesant and attending Boys and Girls High School, it's good that that people in the community that I live in, as well as the community that I'm from, are able to see me, see my story, and know that they can push themselves beyond expectations.
What is it that you've got that the other skiers don't have in terms of advantage? You use outrigger skis, right? You don't use poles.
I am a three-tracker. My classification is LW2, and I do ski on one leg with outriggers.
And there are a lot of skiers that choose poles, that choose outriggers, that have different equipment. What choices have you made and why?
So there's several different classifications in Paralympic skiing. You have standing, visually impaired, and you have sitting. I'm a standing ski racer. I race against people. Anyone that stands up, I race against. I use outriggers because my balance, the level of balance is a lot better when I'm going 75, 80 miles an hour. If I'm making a sharp turn, I'm able to put the outriggers on the snow. A person that will use poles is somebody that, say, ski with a below-the-knee prosthetic leg or someone with a different physical disability, and they have advantages with the poles.
Do you have an advantage with only one leg on some sense, in the sense that you're almost you're snowboarding and skiing at the same time on some level? The physics would seem to favor you under some conditions.
Can a person with one leg hop further than a person with two legs? Absolutely not. There's not an advantage. I think that you take your situation and you make the best out of it. And we're so good at what we do, we make it seem effortlessly, but it takes a lot of work and dedication.
I'm sure it takes a lot of work and dedication. I'm a sit skier, so from a wheelchair, you know, I admire the fact that you guys can stand as three trackers. But sometimes you find that in ways that are very unexpected, the disability can be a help in certain situations. Not that you're going up against able-bodied skiers at the Paralympics, but how have you learned more about your body in this, you know, high level of competition?
Well, you have to know yourself. You have to train hard. You have to want to work harder than every single person that you compete against. And throughout years of repetition, throughout years of skiing, putting over 10,000 miles in, that's when you actually start to learn your character. You actually start to learn how you sit up against everybody else in the country.
And you got shot in in your neighborhood, right? In Bed-Stuy?
I did get shot in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, yes.
Do you ever think you'd get into winter sports at this level at any point at all?
Back then, I always knew I was going to be successful at something. I mean, I was a great student, honor student at Boys and Girls High School, great athlete. Even before high school, I played football with the Brooklyn Hurricanes. I was that dude that everybody knew in Roosevelt houses that I grew up in who was going to be successful. But other than that, you know, I'm literally just another person out on the slopes who's trying to make it happen. You know, another person who has the opportunity, again, to represent this country and to set the bar. But most of all, this is a lot bigger than that. This isn't just about skiing. This is about showing people that no matter where you come from, no matter what walks of life, no matter what struggles, you know, there are opportunities that you can take advantage of, you know, because not only am I a skier, but I'm also a full-time student. You know, I'm also a mentor. So there's a lot of other things on the plate. Skiing is a portion of my life, and hopefully it'll open up doors towards different avenues when I decide to retire.
Well, Ralph Green, good luck, and, you know, the best to you out there on the slopes.
Appreciate it.
Ralph Green represents Team USA in the Paralympic downhill event. How do you change a Supreme Court decision that you don't like? Hire a lawyer, draft a constitutional amendment, start a blog? Uphill battle doesn't begin to describe the arduous process of rewriting the law of the land. The Citizens United case 4 years ago that threw out the rules for contributing money to political campaigns has not been popular, but it has pumped billions into the political process. After Citizens United, corporations and unions were free to channel unlimited amounts of cash into the political action committees and super PACs that were created. But what if all that money contained the message, written on the face, literally, of all those campaign-contributed bills, a message to stamp money out of politics? The money becomes the message. This is the mission of the founders of the ice cream company Ben & Jerry's, Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield, who visited our studios and brought real money stamps and detailed how-to instructions so anyone can stamp an anti-Citizens United political message legally on legal tender.
It's turning money into media. The corporations and the ultra-rich are using money to give to politicians and get them to pass laws that benefit them. I think people who are not so wealthy, regular people, can use money by turning it into media. And so we're stamping messages on paper currency to get this message about getting money out of politics out there, to support an amendment to do that and to support legislation to get money out.
Currency that will remain in circulation with the message, and that everybody who uses that money will see the message.
Absolutely. It, you know, the average dollar bill stays in circulation 5 years, so we estimate that the bill that someone stamps will be at halfway through its lifetime, so it has 2.5 years to go, and that would be 875 viewings as it gets passed around from person to person. So if one person stamped 3 bills a day for a year, that would be about 1 million impressions.
Ben's done a lot of research on how money gets passed around and how long it stays in the system.
And the idea is to use money in circulation as an advertising platform on some level.
Well, it's kind of like a petition on steroids. I mean, usually the only way the average person gets to express their point of view to the political establishment is by signing a petition that hopefully is seen by that person once. This way, people sign a very public petition that's seen by a whole lot of people continually.
And where does it go once you've managed to deface all of the American
We call it
currency?
Adorning. Adorning. It's not defacing. It's
decorating.
Adorning.
Yeah.
Decorating. Thank you.
How do you keep the feds from pulling your bills and just printing different ones?
Well, you need to read the handy-dandy guide to stamping, and it gives you the locations on the bills that the feds are not looking at. We got the RFP, the request for proposals, that the Fed put out to money scanner manufacturers. And so we know what areas of the bill they're looking for, and we don't stamp there. So, I mean, it's no secret.
Jerry, in his face and in the tone of his voice, he sounds like a felon. there's a felonious quality, a conspiratorial quality.
It is totally legal. It's slightly subversive, but totally legal. We got the lawyers, you know, opinions on our website.
So you're not worried?
No. According to the regulations, it's assumed that money is going to get marked by people. And you're not allowed to mark it with an advertising message. And this is clearly a free speech political issue.
How does it become a movement? I mean, other than just a, oh, gosh, those guys got a lot of marked up bills. I mean, what's the jump from impact on money to impact in politics?
Passing resolutions on the municipal level and on the state level. So far, 16 states have passed resolutions or ballot initiatives in favor of this amendment. Whenever it's gone onto the ballot, it's been overwhelming. About 75% are in favor. I think there's probably going to be one in Arkansas. There's 100 members of Congress that have signed on to an amendment, and there's 20-some-odd senators that have.
So it is a high threshold to get a constitutional amendment, and I think it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be an easy thing to do because it's a major thing to do, but this is an enormous issue. It's probably the big issue when you look at the influence in our country in terms of elections, in terms of lobbying. It's all big money, and we all know it. It's not like this is any secret. It's just that most people feel like they can't do anything about it.
You guys know a fair amount about the power of advertising.
Yes,
and
we do.
In some ways, this really channels that expertise of yours to get this message out on a platform that everybody sees, except for the super rich who never use cash.
Yeah, it's grassroots marketing. It's true grassroots guerrilla marketing. It is the original viral marketing.
Now, is there anything I can I get like free Ben & Jerry's ice cream if I send you like a full collection of ones, fives, tens,
you know,
20s, 20s, 100s, 50s.
Involved in the stampede, once you get yourself a stamp and you get to be part of the membership, Ben & Jerry's ice cream comes your way.
But,
I'll
you
just
know,
say
it,
that.
It's an interesting question because, you know, Ben and I are here as individuals, not representing
right.
the company. And the stamp stampede is not an officially sanctioned activity of Ben & Jerry's.
Right, exactly. No, and we're talking grassroots politics and marketing here. And you know, it's different that it's a message coming from you than from, you know, other political activists. I mean, you guys have an important sort of place in the hearts of Americans.
Stomachs.
Because of the success of your, right, the success of your products. What would represent failure of this initiative?
If the amendment doesn't get passed, if federal legislation does not get passed?
You know, what we should all understand is, as I mentioned before, it's a big issue, and there are these very deeply entrenched, wealthy interests that they're pulling the strings. And so it's a big thing to overturn that. It's not going to happen in 6 months, but you got to keep working on it.
Very interesting. Ben and Jerry, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Ben Cohen and Jerry Greenfield are the co-founders of Ben & Jerry's and are leading the campaign, The Stampede, Stamp Money Out of Politics.
And I don't know how to react, or if I should fight back.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals monitor and manage online reviews. Now offering a review kiosk to help customers create reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com.
He reached out to me and to countless others, inspiring so many of us to study, teach, and do science. Science is a cooperative enterprise spanning the generations. It's the passing of a torch from teacher to student to teacher. A community of minds reaching back to antiquity and forward to the stars. Now, come with me. Our journey is just beginning.
astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson's face-to-face encounter with his idol Carl Sagan was a day and a moment in cosmic time, he might say, that he has never forgotten. He recounted that story in the premiere of the new Cosmos series last night, a TV event carrying forward Carl Sagan's mission in his 1980 show Cosmos to a new generation. And that's part of what scientists do, inspire and teach.
Hello, my name is Ann Cummings, and I'm calling from Greenbrae, California. My father became a theoretical physicist. When he met an inspirational teacher, he would tell me, you have to learn the boring stuff, but it gets better. When I graduated from Berkeley with a degree in biophysics and English, it was a conversation with my father about doing something in the real world of day-to-day life that prompted me to apply to medical school.
So many stories from you about who got you into science. Nearly every scientist has such a story. Father, mother, teacher, mentor, and so it goes for our next three guests. From dabbling in other very different fields, each one of them was encouraged to make a deeper dive into science. Former actor Alex Tichy, now a student at Hunter College and an astrophysics intern at the American Museum of Natural History. Former radio DJ Emily Rice, now a professor of astrophysics at the College of Staten Island and CUNY Graduate Center. And we begin with former music major Seth Redfield, who is now a professor of astronomy at Wesleyan University.
What really got in my bones, actually, was seeing the night sky for the first time. So I grew up in Nebraska. We have spectacular dark skies. And I can remember just being inspired just by looking at the Milky Way in all its glory. Throughout my education, I mean, from elementary school to high school, as an undergraduate, I would meet people who were doing natural sciences or astronomy, and they could convey that sense of wonder and discovery that I felt as a kid looking at the night sky.
Is there anyone in particular who convinced you that, Seth, hey, join the club, you can do this?
I was actually a double music astrophysics major, and I was struggling with music versus astronomy, and I went on my first summer research program. I went to Tucson, Arizona, where there's a lot of astronomy done, and I worked with someone named Charlie Lindsay, and I was just fascinated by him and his colleagues that they could live their life working on these amazing problems, and that's what they spent their day on.
So, Emily Rice, who pulled you out of the radio DJ studio and got you into astrophysics?
The great thing is that actually there wasn't any one single person, and there wasn't any one single experience or anything like that. It was just a lot of kind of wandering, and one of my favorite stories to tell is that I was deciding between three majors in college, kind of like Seth.
What were they?
They were physics and astronomy, German and English literature. And the professor that I had had the most experience with was actually an English literature professor. And I went to him during his office hours and said, you know, look, I can't finish all three of these majors in 4 years. What do you think I should do? And my English literature professor said, forget about lit. Like, he said, quote unquote, he said, you can always read books. And if you give up the physics or if you give up the German, it's not, you know, you're not going to be able to go back to it as easily.
What a great piece of advice. Alex, who nudged you?
Really, Cosmos was hugely influential for me. I actually studied theater, but shortly after I graduated, I was kind of falling out of it. I didn't really feel like I wanted to make it a career anymore, and was sort of feeling adrift, and it was around that time that a friend of mine introduced me to Cosmos. I came to it late in life. It's really made a huge impact on me. I started reading science voraciously. I started writing a science blog called Sagan's Brain. I named it after Carl Sagan. And then after that, you know, I decided what I really wanted to do was teach science, teach physics.
So what age were you when you decided that?
I was probably 22 when this happened. So late in life.
Post-college.
Post-college,
and
yeah.
And Sagan just on TV encourages you, empowers
exactly.
you to say, you know, I can go back and completely transform my life.
Totally. And
so you're sitting around watching old DVDs.
Yeah, exactly. Popped
like
it in.
The weekend to kill.
Right.
All right. So, Seth, did you get a Sagan nudge? Anywhere along the line?
Yeah. So I also discovered Cosmos kind of late in life. I was a graduate student. This was before YouTube and before Netflix, and I found it in a closet and
I love
watched
that.
The first.
Cosmos bootlegs. You're watching Cosmos bootlegs.
And I consumed it in one weekend.
Emily, how about you?
I actually brought with me today a VHS tape of the fifth and sixth episodes of the Cosmos series that I bought in college used for, I believe, $2 and have been carding around with me for 15 years. So I was aware of Carl Sagan, definitely, as an undergrad when I was starting to study physics and astronomy. And since then, it's just kind of been in the background a little bit. Like, I haven't been really, really hugely aware of it. And so I, like, even though I had this interest in education and in communication of science to the public and things like that, it was kind of, you know, I kind of had to keep it in the background for a long time, for several years. But now that I have a faculty position, I can kind of let it out a little bit more. And so it's nice to be kind of still continuously inspired by Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson and, you know, these people that everybody knows their names now, which is fantastic. For people to have scientists as popular figures on TV, that's really fantastic to have rock star scientists.
Well, entertainment is one thing, and, you know, acquiring knowledge is great. But it sounds like from all three of you that on some level, in the midst of the distractions of success and what's my next track and choosing my major and all that, you need permission to really enter into the place where you can ask the big questions. How does the universe work? What are we here for? How do you get yourself to sit in the Sagan chair to ask the big questions about, you know, what is the cosmos?
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, I think I've always looked at, and certainly when I was growing up, you know, math was hard. I mean, math is hard. It's hard for a lot of people. Now, yeah, Emily's shaking her head. It's doable. But that was a sort of a shift that I had to make in my mind. I kind of looked at myself being like, oh, you're not smart enough to do that. Yeah. And that's not true. You know, you can do this sort of stuff if you devote yourself. It's not unachievable. And
even
I think
a theater major.
Exactly. Yeah. Someone like me, you know, it's not out of reach. And I think there's this myth that it's really just for these elite minds, that there are very few of us out there. And that's just not the case.
Seth, the big questions?
Yeah, I think asking the big questions is a deeply human desire. I think we have this insatiable desire to consider these big questions. Where are we from? How did this begin? And to place ourselves in some sort of cosmic context. And we do it in many different ways, right? We express it in our art, our philosophy, religion. And so I think everybody asks these questions. Everybody sits down, thinks about them. And I think that's why the Cosmos series was so powerful, right? It presented a scientific view of phenomenon that's occurring in our world and in our universe. But at the same time, it really connected us with this deep human experience and desire to put ourselves in some broader context.
Well, Alex, Seth, and Emily, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Dr. Sagan would be proud.
Billion.
Three young scientists inspired by Carl Sagan. Here's another would-be cosmologist, Diana Richard from Providence, Rhode Island. I first watched Cosmos with my parents and then watched it again 30 years later online. Sagan's enthusiasm still inspires in me excitement about science and space. Share your story. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Off to another universe now. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.